This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
They know that that's not a great sell. So you can't have Betty Crocker on there selling it like that every night. So instead, you reimagine it. When it comes to issues like this, man, does it not land well to get on the news and say, it's an A-plus economy.
Now, the problem came when China released a sequence and started warning about this new virus and showing propaganda films and all sorts of things like that. Now Fauci had a problem.
So just quickly, because we have a bunch to get to, Michael Knowles is going to join us as we're going to talk about affordability and infighting on the right. Jeffrey Tucker is going to join us. We'll talk about more about the Fauci stuff. He finished reading all that Fauci diary notebook stuff. We're going to get to all those things in the show. But I wanted to remind you of something that we can never forget, and it's easy to lose sight of this. I want to remind you that the communist, it's not just that he lies all the time. It's not just that. It's that his lies serve a purpose, a very important purpose. He's not like one of these people who just lies for fun. You know, I used to know a guy like this. I used to work with a guy like this. And he would, whatever sport you were doing, you could be shooting pool, and he would tell you he used to play professionally. He, I'm not kidding, told me one time that he used to play professional cornhole. Like, there's no purpose for that. He's just a liar. But communists don't operate in that way. The reason they lie all the time about everything is they have very evil plans for you and your country and everything you care about. And what's more, they know these plans are evil. They know these plans are destructive. And they know that you don't want that. Who looks around and says, man, I hope someone would come along and just burn all this stuff down? People don't want it. So if people don't want what you're selling, make yourself a sleazy used car salesman. If people don't want that Pontiac sitting there because they think it's going to break down, and let's say you don't have any morals at all, your only care is the sale itself, what do? You lie. You just lie. Lies are required if you're a communist. Now, how you lie is important as well. You see, they'll take the most despicable things, horrible things in the world, and what they'll do is they'll pull it, they'll focus group it, they'll massage the words as much as possible to make whatever demonic thing they're doing sound not that bad or almost nice. A great example of this is women's reproductive rights. What are they talking about? Butchering unborn babies. That's what it is. Butchering unborn babies, snipping off their heads and killing unborn babies. But that's a tough sell, isn't it? How many people do you know want to talk about snipping off a baby's head? Not many, but women's reproductive rights. Oh, that sounds good. I like women's rights. One of the words that needs to set off alarms in your head every single time you hear it is when they use a term they love so much, and that term is reimagine. They're always reimagining something. We need to reimagine this and reimagine capitalism and reimagine this. All reimagine means is destroy. Reimagine means destroy, period. Now, destroy is a hard sell. Reimagine? Look, they love it.
Reimagining impact requires leaders who will reimagine and who will be unafraid to do so.
We need local communities to reimagine policing, reimagine what safety for all looks like.
We have got to, in America, reimagine how we are accomplishing public safety.
This will be a moment to reimagine reinvent, and recreate.
Right now, the mayor is carrying out, trying to reimagine public safety and get us out of this process of just thinking police officers is what is needed as public safety, but thinking about the other pieces of it. And Minneapolis, I think, is on the right track at the moment.
What do we do to make life better for everybody? We certainly have enough. I mean, we just created the most number of billionaires in the history of the world. You know, we have enough. We could do this, but it's going to take some imagination, reimagining of what America is, what our economic system is, because what's clear is it's not working and it's not sustainable.
Isn't it wild how often they say it? And you'll hear it again. And the next time you hear it, you're going to sit up in your chair. Now, just remember this part before we go to Michael. When they say reimagine, this is what they mean.
So we're going to put up on the screen a few of the things that are part of your platform. And I want to ask you, just give me sort of a true or false on these. Abolish the Senate.
True.
Okay. Replace the presidency and Supreme Court as we now know them.
Yep.
Abolish ICE.
Absolutely.
Abolish borders and give amnesty to anyone currently in the U.S. illegally.
As a long-term plan, yep.
Defund the Pentagon.
Absolutely.
Abolish prisons, at least in large part.
Yeah, again, that as part of a long-term program, yeah.
Okay, so no prisons. Government or public ownership of most large corporations.
Yeah.
That's what they mean. They know that that's not a great sell. So you can't have Betty Crocker on there selling it like that every night. So instead, you reimagine it. All right. We're going to go talk to Michael about all kinds of things. Affordability. What's the future primary look like in 2028 and more? Hang on. Here's what sucks about RT levels. Just going to give it to you right between the eyes. Your dad in 1960... he didn't have to be proactive. He just didn't. We didn't have water that was full of estrogen, and he could just be a dude, and everything would work out fine. We don't live in that world anymore. We have synthetic estrogens in the water supply. The result of that is 50 years, we've lost 50% of our testosterone. Half. Half. We won't continue as a country if this trend continues. So what are you going to do about it? Well, I know there's a clinic on every corner now because everyone knows this is a problem. But do you think a needle being jammed in your arm is a good long-term solution? Or should you maybe find something natural? Try a Male Vitality Stack from Chalk. Natural herbal supplements, the highest quality. 20% increase in your T levels in 90 days. I take a Male Vitality Stack every day. I have for over four years now. I feel amazing. Chalk.com/JesseTV. Well, far be it for me to do much reading of the Daily Beast. I mean, honestly, I can hardly read anyway, but the headline did jump out at me. Vance fat shames a MAGA ally in bonkers meltdown. That sounds awesome. Joining me now, my friend Michael Knowles, of course, of the wonderful Michael Knowles Show. Michael, there's been all kinds of a hubbub hours on affordability this and affordability that. And is the country just hopelessly screwed and can't afford anything anymore? Or is it just that you're not pulling yourself up by your bootstraps enough? I hand the whole thing over to you. What's your take on all this?
Well, thank you, sir. The entire conservative movement was at each other's throats yesterday over a burrito. They were at each other's burritos, which sounds evocative and kind of gross. But the reason for this, it came out in that what you there and there she is. Yeah, right. That's I was at the burrito this morning, too. The reason for this, as you alluded to with the J.D. Vance Mark Thiessen fight, was because you had these two camps of the conservative movement fighting all day. You had Andrew Colvett versus, who was it, Joel Berry. You had Ben Shapiro versus Matt Walsh. And it was essentially the libertarian and the more neocon-y side versus the populists and the more traditionalist side. And the question was not just about burritos. It was not just about the economy. It was how should we react when normal people complain about the economy? And normal people are entirely banished from political Twitter and politics generally. So the more libertarian neocon-y side said that the way we should react is by calling them a bunch of stupid ingrates who should just eat ramen noodles. And the more populist traditionalist side said the way that we should react is by, I really want to end the Iran war. So I think both sides were kind of speaking past each other a little bit. I do have a lot of sympathy, though, for the more trad and kind of populist side, which doesn't always worship at the altar of the free market, likes free markets, but recognizes that markets serve people. And when people say they're having trouble paying the bills, we should listen to them because this is a democracy and you're supposed to show respect to your constituents. And I go back to my buddy Ben Shapiro, who, you know, he's making all these points about how grocery prices actually haven't risen all that much in recent years, though they rose a lot during COVID. And there are other bad economic indicators. But Ben loves to say facts don't care about your feelings, which is totally true. The problem is that politics exclusively cares about your feelings. And so I think Vance made a great point on Laura Ingraham's show, which is he said, look, socialism is evil. We don't want socialism. A lot of people are voting for socialists right now because the socialists are talking about affordability. So if you want to avoid socialism, the thing you have to do is talk about the economic hardship that people are feeling and then channel it in a good direction. And the main way that we should do that is blame the immigrants because it's basically all their fault.
Well, you're not necessarily wrong on that. My problem with this, with so much of this debate, Michael, because there are great points on both sides. And like you said, a lot of people just have agendas and it's just monkeys throwing poop at each other. I'm not worried about that, but there are good points to be had. My problem, honestly, it comes clear from the top, Michael, honestly, with Donald Trump himself, is how we're messaging the fact that people remember what it was like 5-6 years ago to afford more things. This is not 50 years ago, 5 or 6 yeah. years ago, you could afford more than you can afford now. The American people hated it with the fire of 1,000 suns when Joe Biden would go to the camera and tell them how great they had it. It's great. The economy's great. If you guys just aren't reporting on it, they hated it because you don't kick dirt in someone's face when they're down and tell them how great it is. I understand full well that it is Donald Trump's way. Everything's the best ever, the best looking ever, the greatest ever, the golden. I understand that that's his way, and I like it. I enjoy it. When it comes to issues like this, man, does it not land well to get on the news and say, it's an A-plus economy, golden age, stock market's never been higher. If you're sitting at home crying about your grocery bill, that doesn't land well.
No, it doesn't. And so I think actually the administration has a pretty good argument to make here, but they have to acknowledge the problem because the socialists are making hay on it. And what the Trump administration could say is, look, the cost of groceries actually hasn't risen all that much over the last 2 years, but it did rise a ton during the Biden years. It did. The inflation was massive. And so you're feeling that. It's not, it doesn't go in the other direction. The prices never really come down. So we're working on that. But the biggest drivers of costs right now, it's not actually the burritos. It's not exactly your groceries, though some groceries are more expensive. The biggest driver of costs is housing. I mean, that's where you're really seeing housing jump from, I think it was 2019 to 2024. Housing jumped up like 30% in prices, but wages only rose about 9%. And so, you know, that's a huge delta that people are still dealing with. And, you know, the biggest drivers of this are bad regulation. You know, you're seeing the housing prices and the grocery prices and the energy prices really jumping in those Democrat cities and states. But the other big drivers here are mass migration. You know, there was a study came out last year showed that 100% of the growth in home prices in California and New York was due to mass migration. And nationally, it was 60%. So this is something that the Trump administration is working to fix. They just booted 350,000 Haitians out of the country today. And the argument to keep the Haitians here, by the way, from the left, was that the Haitians owned homes and had mortgages. Well, they shouldn't own homes. They shouldn't have mortgages. American citizens should. So you can make those arguments and you can say, look, a lot of this is the left's fault. All of the prescriptions they have for you, these socialist candidates, are only going to make the problem worse. And there is a problem right now. We've done some good to fix it. We got more good that is, it's going to take a little while to actually see the effects of that. And they do have a weak point on the Iran war because The Iran war hasn't actually driven up energy costs all that much, but it could over time, and it's bad optics, and people just kind of viscerally feel it. So you have to acknowledge the problem. Yeah, it is hard out there in the economy, man. And the reasons are mass migration, overregulation, not building houses, not Democrats taking a long time to open up energy. And we're fixing that right now. You've seen some good effects, and you got more to come, but don't elect socialists in the meantime.
Let's flip it to the other side, because you mentioned the more neocon, neoconservative types who kind of seem like they're on the outs. That's probably inevitable. The American people don't care about foreign policy anymore when they're a little bit more hard up. That's just the way it goes. But it's impossible not to notice that the Venn diagram of people who wave their pom-poms as hard as possible to go to war with Iran are the exact same people who are telling everybody to shut up and go make top ramen. Does it all really just come back to this? And honestly, I'm not even trying to be insulting, because some people have just different views of the country. Does it come back to everything should be messaged and packaged and talked about in such a way that we can keep dropping bombs on Iran, because that is the most important thing in the world. That is the direction everything that can go, and everything that encourages that should be loudly championed, and everything that might hurt that cause should be slapped down immediately, because that's how it seems, Mike.
The neocon side is just completely tone deaf here. And, you know, you don't have to give up the fact that America is a big empire. It's a global empire. A lot of our economy and our society is actually dependent upon our maintaining the global order. But this is an unpopular war that was true from the beginning, and it's truer now. People just look at it, and with common sense, they say, hold on, how come we can afford all these missiles, but we can't afford to build new housing in the United States? And I think the neocon side has made a huge error, which is to preen and to come off as these sort of sneering pedants to say, well, you just don't understand economics. You know, why don't you just go make top ramen? Why don't you pull yourself up by your bootstraps? But it's also politically wrong. They actually misunderstand politics, because while, yes, we encourage individuals to hustle and do the best they can and make something of themselves, we're talking about politics here. And so you can't just ignore political solutions. You know, we're willing to talk about grand strategy and political systems when it comes to bombing the Middle East. But all of a sudden, when it comes to domestic strife, we say, hands off, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, we're not going to help you. That doesn't make sense. And there's a deeply conservative insight that we get from Benjamin Disraeli over in the UK, which is that the palace is not safe when the cottage is unhappy. So you actually do have to listen to the people. It is conservative to be responsive to the people. Politics classically involves three parts: the logical part, the thematic, spirited part, and the appetitive part. That's why our congressmen get elected every 2 years. They have to be very sensitive to what the people want. And here, the people are saying, look, we have a lot of economic hardship. The worst possible thing you can say to them is, no, you don't. It's actually great. Shut up. Stop whining. You're a loser. It's political suicide, and it's just not true, okay? You know, in fact, a lot of the reason why Republicans have gotten elected in recent years is because we have appealed to ordinary common sense concerns of the American people. So to sell that now, you're going to see the exact same effects that you saw the last time Republicans did this in 2008, 2009, and that was Democrat rule for many years.
This is part of my problem with those of us, you, me, everybody watching right now, who get involved, and I'm glad we're involved and knowledgeable and spend our time online about political issues. We can obviously get way too close to the forest to see the trees. Donald Trump is president again because of affordability and immigration. It's not because of MAHA or my bad. It's not that that didn't matter. It's not because of this or that issue. People couldn't afford stuff. They were mad at Democrats who voted for Donald Trump. And there are certain inevitables. We are going to get massacred at the midterms if something is not done in the next few months. It is inevitable. It can't be avoided. Another thing inevitable is J.D. Vance. Donald Trump reporting out there today saying that J.D. Vance is going to be his guy. And there'll be all this weeping and gnashing of teeth, and I don't like coronations either, but J.D. Vance just won the primary. If he gets Trump's blessing, it's over. We'll argue about it on Twitter and throw monkey poop at each other. But again, this is one of those things that's inevitable. There are things that are inevitable.
Yes. And, you know, even with this shadow fight over Vance, you've seen this big public campaign against Vance in recent weeks, I think because some of the donor class, some of the pundit kind of out of touch class, they don't like J.D. Vance for whatever reason. They think he's too conservative, or I don't know, he's not their kind of conservative. So they were trying to get Rubio to run. There was no indication that Rubio wanted to run. They were trying to create division between Vance and the president. But this is really, in my mind, a replay of 2016. It's, in most cases, all the very same people who in 2016 were running the Never Trump movement, making all the same arguments that they made against Trump back in 2016, they're making against Vance now, that he's betraying libertarian economics by leaning into economic populism, that he's an isolationist. They're insinuating that he harbors some kind of bigotry without any evidence really of that at all. They're suggesting this is a betrayal of, you know, the sacred fusionist Reagan coalition, which again, I think that Trump and Vance are really more heirs to the Reagan coalition than traitors to it. But in any case, you know, history repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce. We are seeing those same dynamics play out. That was always going to happen at the end of the Trump era, but Trump took over the GOP, and the GOP voters wanted him to do that. And so whoever Trump picks is going to be the nominee. It seems to me that J.D. Vance was the heir apparent from the minute he picked him to be his running mate back in 2024. And I hope the GOP gets in line. I hope they don't just try to take their ball and go home. But we're relitigating the same battle that was fought in 2016. And I think Trump won a decisive victory there. So I think he gets to pick the nominee.
Let's switch sides and start beating up on communists, because that's my favorite thing in the world. Chuck Schumer, all these Democrats, really, they're all saying the same thing. In response to these DSA commie types winning primaries, they keep going out and they say stuff like this.
And Manu.
Thank you. Is the rise of the DSA good for your party?
Look, we are a big tent party, and being a big tent party is a strength, not a weakness.
We can skip past all the obvious stuff. Chuck Schumer is obviously terribly afraid of getting primaried and losing his seat and all this other stuff. Michael, the DSA is inevitable. I don't know why people can't see this coming. It's not the future. It's the now. They will continue to destroy all these Democrats. And this is the way the Democrat Party is going. And there's nothing you or I can do to stop it.
It's not just the way the Democrat Party is going. It's the way the Democrat Party is. This, to me, is the most obvious takeaway from these primaries that very few people seem to be talking about, which is, the takeaway occurred before Election Day. And the takeaway is there's really no difference between the Democrat socialist candidates and the ordinary mainstream establishment Democrat candidates. Whether you're looking at Abdul El-Sayed, whether you're looking at Cori Bush getting beaten again, whether you're looking at really any of these candidates, you see there's the radical DSA candidate and then the more establishment candidate, but they agree on everything. They agree on abolishing ICE. They agree on transing the kids. They agree on abortion up until the moment of birth or later. They agree on amnesty for illegals. They agree on letting the criminals out of prison. They agree about basically everything. Some of them have a little more spice to their branding where they are overtly socialist, but the establishment Dems in basically all of these races agreed with the socialists on all of their policies. So Chuck Schumer says, well, you know, we're a big tent party here in the Democrats. No, you're not. You're all exactly the same. You're all progressives slash socialists on policy matters with a few mild disagreements over, I don't know, how much money to give to Israel. Some of them hate Israel a little bit more than the others do. Some of them only want to trans the 7-year-olds rather than the 5-year-olds. But basically, they all agree on everything. So yeah, it's a big wide tent of exactly the same people. And the Democrats are getting what they have asked for and deserved for a long time. And it couldn't happen to a nicer party.
Amen. Does it come down to this, and this is not my term, but I'm going to steal it because I don't know who to give credit to, that it's basically a purity death spiral. There are no more guardrails. You can't be too far left in any Democrat primary anywhere. There's no longer some elder powerful statesman to step in and say, hey, okay, AOC, shut your mouth and go back to the Bronx for a little while. That person doesn't exist. That entity doesn't exist anymore. So now it's just left forever.
Yeah, well, it's because of their ideology. It's just because of time playing out in their ideology. So, you know, the minute they embraced the feminism, say, of the 1960s, which said that men and women are exactly the same, basically the same, the minute you had that, you had to get the gay rights movement because that was just saying men and women are basically the same. You had to get same-sex marriage because that just says men and women are the same. Then you had to get transgenderism, which says the same thing. Then you have to trans the kids. If transgenderism is possible in human nature, then it could happen to a kid just as much as it could happen to an adult. So there was this kind of logic from their false premises that meant they were always going to get here so long as they embrace this liberal ideology. And the conservatives are in this way lucky. The fact that we fight about burritos is actually a strength for the GOP, because there are all these different factions, the neocons and the libertarians and the traditionalists and the populists and the religious right, and on and on and on. We say that obscure political monikers are the right-wing version of gender pronouns. But the fact that you got all these little groups here, they all disagree with each other over, like, everything. They really do have different philosophical premises and ideological bases. And really what unites them is a common enemy. We don't want the socialists to rise up. So that's great, because within the GOP, you get all these little checks on some of the ideological inclinations. The Dems don't have that. And so Chuck Schumer doesn't want to get primaried by AOC or whoever the next socialist is in New York. But when it comes to the real issues on immigration, on the economy, on transgenderism, on foreign wars or whatever, there's really no difference between him and a socialist. So in that way, he's kind of made himself obsolete. And the GOP doesn't have to face that. The only fear is that we're going to get blown out in the midterms by the most radical spate of candidates, which are coming from the left, that we've ever had in the history of the United States.
Michael, you have a lapel mic on, but then you have a mic stand sitting there. And I can't help but wonder, is the mic stand just a prop? Do you have a prop mic in your studio? Is it functional?
This is not only functional, but it's very, very expensive. This mic is my real mic, but I'm a good conservative, and I'm always prepared for when the libs try to cut my power, clip my audio. Jesse, you will not lose me. I will be backed up here. I have contingency after contingency. They will not take me down.
I believe in you, Michael Knowles. Thank you, my brother. Come back soon. The great Jeffrey Tucker, he finished all those Fauci diary documents, and man, does he have a lot to say. Next. We have to put our money where our morals are. We've talked about that many, many times before, but in some ways are easy, and some ways are difficult. Wireless is easy. Everybody has a cell phone. Everybody. I do, you do, everybody's got a cell phone now. Shoot, we got four of them in my house. The big wireless companies are disgusting. They take your money and they fund every putrid commie cause. Go look up your wireless company in Pride Month and then realize that you fund it. That's a fact. Well, you can switch to Pure Talk. They're on the same network. You're not sacrificing coverage. You're paying less, fraction of the cost of the big guys. And your money's actually going to a company that is about veterans, led by a Vietnam veteran. And they hire Americans. Nobody does that anymore. But when you inevitably have to get a hold of somebody at Pure Talk, you will speak to an American. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV and make the switch. Well, he's back. He's like my favorite person in the world. And right now he's just, he's got to be giddy because Jeffrey Tucker, who obsesses over things in ways that you or I can only dream of, has actually finished the Fauci diary, I guess we're calling it. It's not a diary. That's not what it is. I'm guilty of that too, calling it that. But Jeffrey correctly scolded everybody. It's not really what it is. We're going to ask him what it is and what else is in there. Because remember the first little bit of outrage? That was a little teeny tiny fraction of what the whole thing said. Joining me now, the wonderful Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey, I hand you the floor. What else did you find?
Well, in the early January 2021, before the shots were really released to the general public, he got a warning from the world's most prominent virologist in the UK that Delta variant had already arrived. And a few days later, and he said it's diminished the effectiveness of the vaccine. And a few days later, he came back and said, look, you give this shot to people, it will be completely useless for stopping infection and spread. And so that's on the record. And so Fauci knew this. He knew it going into it, and he pushed the product and mandated anyway. And by the way, Fauci responded to him, well, I guess we're just going to have to reformulate the shot. You know, we're going to have to reformulate it. But he didn't do anything about it. He just went ahead with the thing anyway. I mean, that's one of many revelations that I think it exposes a darkness about Fauci that even I hadn't entirely understood.
Jeffrey, could you clarify something for me? The shot itself, what was with the, was it just, did it just come down to money, big pharma money? Why were so many people, Fauci himself, obsessed with pretending it worked, lying about it working, pushing it on to everybody, pushing it on to children? I don't want to hear that it hurts people. I don't want to hear that it doesn't do this. It was all gas, no brakes on this particular thing. Does it just come down to greed?
Profits are part of it. No question, pharmaceutical power. But there's the second factor that Fauci really wanted to put in play, mRNA technology, because it would be the most profitable tool in history. It's a kind of a technology that allows instantaneous printing, more or less. Stick in this sequence of virus, print out the product, jab the potion into people, and it could be used for anything. So he wanted that online, and he had been working on that for 30 years. And he never had a way to get through the FDA, which would never have approved this product. So that, in an emergency use situation, it became just impossible to resist the chance to finally deploy his favorite thing, which would make him go down history and the industry make billions and trillions of dollars. But there's another factor here, too, and I think it's actually the dominant one. Everything that happened from late January all the way to his resignation was about covering up the lab leak that he himself had funded. He had found a circuitous way to work with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and he had hoped to pass off the resulting flu, the SARS-CoV-2 that came out of the lab. Engineered this by manipulated spike protein. He'd hoped to pass it off as a bad flu year. That's why early, the very first thing that happens in the notebooks or the diaries, I call them diaries too. My objection is they're not private diaries. They're written with staff and with a large staff on government computers. The very first thing that happens is he starts warning about a bad flu year. Now, why would he do this? I think it's because he had hoped that, so he already knew about SARS-CoV-2 in probably September, October of 2019, but his hope was that he, because of the gradient of effect, that mostly it was going to affect the elderly and the infirm, that he could sort of bury the lab leak within a sort of a larger framework of a bad flu year. So he starts warning about a bad flu year, and that was his hope. Now, the problem came when China released the sequence and started warning about this new virus and showing propaganda films and all sorts of things like that. Now Fauci had a problem, which was he will be considered the villain of the universe if he was responsible for funding and creating this virus that was now got the world in panic. So plan A was to bury the fatalities within a bad flu year. Plan B was to lock down the country, create all sorts of chaos, censorship, mitigate according to the plans of the craziest person you can believe, like Bill Gates, and then wait for the shot. So the shot was his way to convert his infamy into valor. And so he had everything in that basket. He rested everything on that. So when people started coming to him and said, look, I'm sorry, you cannot outrun the mutations of a respiratory virus. It's not going to work. He had to put his fingers in his ears and pretend like he wasn't hearing it. So he tried to delay endemicity. That's what flattening the curve means. It means we're going to prolong the pain as long as possible. We're going to keep you from gaining natural immunities to this virus. And then we're going to get a shot out there. And then, it's going to work. And I don't care what you say. So he wouldn't listen to anybody tell him it wasn't going to work. He thought, well, I'll generate studies as we usually do with fake data, fake causal inferences, and convince the public that the shots are magic, when in fact they are useless, as he was told. But he had no plan C, essentially. That was the problem. So that's why he leaned so heavily into the shots. And the idea is if he can vaccinate as much as 80 or 90% of the population, the pandemic goes away, as they all do. And then he would manipulate the data and claim credit for having saved everybody on the planet. So he can convert his villainy into valor through these shots and these shots alone. And as for the impact on kids, the resulting injuries and death, the complete calamity that the spike protein caused the health of the population, he just didn't care. He cared only about one thing, and that was Anthony Fauci and his reputation. This comes through very clearly in the diaries because he spends, I don't know, probably 30-40% of the text talking about all the celebrities, celebrity endorsements he's collected, and the awards he's getting. He wanted to make himself invulnerable, foolproof to criticism, make it impossible for anybody in power to turn on him. So he was running a sort of a machinery of influencer protection from the very early stages of this thing all the way to the last until Rand Paul and many others were on to him. Up to that time, he was able to dismiss me and other critics and the great Branson Declaration epidemiologists and everybody as cranks and fools and get the national media to censor these people. But at some point in 2022, his luck ran out and he became very unpopular. And when the ruling class started blaming him for the low uptake of the boosters and the decline in acceptance of his product, then he got the worst result that anybody in a sales job would have received, which is sort of bad numbers, right? So at some point he was told to shut up because he's actually diminishing shot uptake, that his reputation had declined to the point that he had to go if only to save the industry that he himself created.
Jeffrey, it's not to set Fauci aside, but there is something, as long as we're on the subject of the shots and the timing in January, those of us who are complete nerds about this, like you and me, will remember that the shot itself, Donald Trump, Operation Warp Speed, one of the worst freaking things ever, but be that as it may, greased the skids to get this thing on the market. But Big Pharma held it back from the big announcement until about 5 minutes after Donald Trump lost the election. Why?
This was for entirely political reasons. Fauci recognized pretty early on that his claim to media fame was to serve as a kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge, I'm a foil to Trump. If you hate Trump, you should love me. If you love me, celebrate me, make baseball cards, make bobbleheads, make cupcakes out of my image, put me on all your shows. That's your way of going after Trump. So it was a kind of a very stupid political ploy he was involved in. The media played along, and he knew exactly what he was doing. This is why he would visibly signal disdain for Trump behind his back. He was dealing with the media in a kind of surreptitious way. He would call all these top reporters and tell them he can't stand Trump. Trump's a monster. He's an enemy. But if they celebrate him, then he'll continue to drive the economy into the ground, destroy everybody's lives, keep everybody in panic, close downtowns and shut schools, and create the conditions that will allow for mail-in ballots, which were authorized on March 12th, 2020, right in the thick of everything. And so that we would use COVID, he, Fauci, together with the media that hated Trump, to guarantee that he would lose the election. The only thing that might have changed that calculation would have been an early release of the shots for which Trump would get credit. So they were delayed and delayed. And Fauci intervened even one time and sent Pfizer back to trials based on the bogus reason that they were insufficiently racially diverse. It's a true story. Just to delay the shots until after the election. So they had it all sewn up. And Fauci was cheered by the media that hated Trump and feared what Trump stood for, which is a kind of a populist revolution. Jesse, there was always a political element to this because the fingerprints are all over it. Trump did the unprecedented thing 2 years prior, you recall, in firing James Comey. Now, the head of the FBI is supposed to be invulnerable to any kind of political intervention. The FBI is supposed to be above it all. The people aren't supposed to have any control over it. Trump arrived in 2016 thinking of himself as the CEO and gradually got the sense that there was a government within the government. He was, ostensibly president, but he actually wasn't in charge. And he was determined to take charge. Well, the FBI kicked off an investigation of him as a possible Russian agent, right? And when he got wind of this, he just went after Comey and said that you're an idiot once you're fired. But the job of firing him fell to a Justice Department employee, an old-time bureaucrat who was otherwise quiet, named Rod Rosenstein. And so he had to write the letter firing Comey. So that's sort of what kicked off the COVID thing. His sister worked for the CDC. Her name was Nancy Messonnier. And it was she who on February 24th of all times gathered all the national media, the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Bloomberg, everybody, and said, this virus is very bad. We are going to lock down the country. We're going to close the schools, close the businesses. And it's the only way to mitigate against this terrible thing. Now, she did this without ever checking with the White House. She never asked Trump, much less anybody else at the White House, except for a few people within the National Security Council who were working with her on this grand plot. And that's what they whipped up in the media into a complete frenzy. By 4 days later, it was a done deal. Every media outlet was screaming about the deadly virus that was in our midst and how we all should just panic and stay home and start spraying our groceries. Now, keep in mind, the White House wasn't involved at any level at this point, but so things were already wildly out of his control. So by the time they got to Trump himself, it was a little more than a week later. It was March 9th, and they had a full court press of people he trusted. So people told him that Fauci is a great guy. He needs to trust Fauci. Fauci knows what's what. He's not partisan. He's just a pure scientist. Tucker Carlson, of all people, was manipulated into going to Trump and whispering in his ear. He was talked to by a guy by the name of, I can't prove this, but I'm almost certain of it. His name was Matt Podinger, who was one of these guys who was a kind of China hawk and trusted within conservative circles. He got to Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson got to Fauci. And then the omnipresent Jared Kushner was there too, with his friends in the tech biotech industry, data industry, who assured the president that locking down the country was the way to go. And there's one more piece of the puzzle, namely the vice president. So Pence was all over it. Yep, Mr. President, you've got to lock down the country. So he was completely outnumbered by everybody around him. And of course, Fauci and Birx were all over the place. So he didn't know anybody who had any doubts about this. And he greenlighted it on March the 10th. And that's when the mail-in ballots were authorized. That's when the emergency came along. That's when the PREP Act was invoked on March 13th. And then he gave his catastrophic press conference on March the 16th, in which he didn't entirely know what the press conference was about, other than to say, "Don't worry about it. We're gonna do our best for this virus. We've got the best people." And it was Fauci at that press conference who rocked up to the microphone and read from a sheet that said you have to close your bars and restaurants and schools and not gather with anybody within 6 feet. So, which in effect closed the churches too. So he did this at the press conference. At that press conference, there was a weird thing that happened while Fauci was reading the sentence, to which Trump would surely object. Somebody in the audience got Trump's attention, and Trump wasn't actually listening. He was saying hi to somebody in the audience, and the sentence ended. Trump got reengaged, got back up to the microphone, started taking questions. So that's how that fell out. Now, it was less than a month later that he realized what was going on. It was March 23rd, and we know this from Fauci's notebooks, towards an autobiography that we're calling the diaries. On March 23rd, Trump called in Deborah Birx into his office and said, "You and Dr. Fauci have betrayed me. You've lied to me. You're destroying the country. Everything you said was wrong. You gave terrible advice. I never want to hear from you again. You are horrible people for what you've done to me and to the country." That was April 23rd. So from that point on, Trump was ready to clean house. But then it became very difficult, because that's when the media celebrations of Fauci kicked up, and the plot was to make him essentially unfireable, invulnerable, indispensable to the nation's response. So Trump was in many ways sort of trapped. And it took him a long time before he thought his way out of this trap. It was all the way until August when he finally tapped somebody with a different point of view, and that was, of course, Scott Atlas.
Jeffrey, thank you for keeping this on. But this is, it's really, really important that we never forget. Thank you, my friend. All right, final thoughts. Next. I'm glad we just got to talk to Jeffrey Tucker, because it drives home the fact how much these people are simply destroyers and how nefarious they are about destruction. It's what communists do. It's what Democrats do. And they do it on purpose. And they don't care that it's hurting people, hurting kids, killing people. It never crosses their mind. So don't ever, under any circumstances, let any of these people reimagine anything for you, ever. They do not have your best interests at heart. We'll do it again.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.